Hi. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Mr. President. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good.
My mom just wanted to say hi to you, Mr. President. Let me give her the headphones for a second and let you speak to her for a little. Here you go.
Hi, Mr. President.
Hello. How are you?
Good. And you? How are you?
I'm doing great. Are you guys weathering the storm all right? Have you got power?
Yeah, we have power right now. We're okay. So, and Steven and the rest of the family, they don't have a power and water for like 4 days, so.
Well, be safe. I know you're proud of your son.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Say hi to Miss Hillary Clinton.
I will. Thank you. Bless
you. Okay, bye-bye.
The summer of 1963, between my junior and senior years of high school, was one of the most formative periods of my life. I was seriously considering pursuing a life in public service at the time that I attended Boys State, a program sponsored by the American Legion. Along with the American Legion Auxiliary's Girl State, this program brings high school juniors together to learn how government works and to experience for themselves what it takes to run for office and then to serve. Attendees are divided into two fictional political parties. Then they draft platforms, hold elections for local and state offices, and vote on issues in legislative sessions. At the end of the week, two senators are elected to represent their state at Boys Nation, held later in the summer. I was lucky enough to be one of the two from Arkansas back in 1963, giving me the chance to visit Washington for the first time, meet fascinating people from all over the country, and even shake hands with President Kennedy. So why am I telling you this? Because Boys State and Boys Nation helped to teach me from a young age that democracy requires us to get off the sidelines and into the arena. Imperfect as it may be, we can't take this system of ours for granted. And if we want to make it better and make a difference in people's lives, we need to stand up, show up, and speak up day after day and year after year. Today, I'm joined by a remarkable young man whose own experience at Boys State is inspiring people across America. Stephen Garza is the breakout star and in many ways the hero of the critically acclaimed documentary Boys State, which follows 1,000 boys from across Texas in the summer of 2018 as they met to learn how to build a representative democracy from the ground up. In the film, Stephen shows us the value of believing in yourself and your principles, the power of honest dialogue to bridge our divides, and how we can breathe new life into our democracy. Stephen became the first high school graduate in his family and is now a sophomore at the University of Texas at Austin. He has a strong desire to take what he's learned to serve his community and to be an advocate for others. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, Mr. President, and thank you for taking some time to say hi to my mom, who's a big fan.
Perhaps we could start by telling us how the storm has affected you and your family and how you're doing and what's your reaction to it all is.
Like many Texans, it was a very rough week last week. For some Texans, it was a deadly week. Our power went out at about 2 o'clock in the morning on Monday and didn't come back fully until about Wednesday night. Our water went out Tuesday. And when it came back, we realized that about 7 pipes in our house had broken, one of them actually above my bed and one of them in my closet. So it wasn't very pleasant to deal with. And it's been, a rough few years to, you know, especially being a Houstonian, living through these climate events again. And in 2017, we had Hurricane Harvey completely decimate the city, once in 1,000-year storm. And now, you know, 2 or 3 years later, now we have this once in a generation winter storm. And these once in a generation, once in a lifetime events are becoming, once every couple of years, you know, in Texas and all across the country. And addressing, you know, human activity and the climate is instrumental in tackling that. And there's this good quote that I've seen going around is that that you shouldn't place people who don't believe in government in charge of government. Otherwise, you end up with situations like we just had, and people don't believe that government can be used as a source for good and positive change in people's lives.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, it's just such an easy cop-out. We may have cultural differences, and we may have, you know, factual arguments about whether this or that policy would work or not. But hating the government is a loser. I mean, I remember it reached a fever pitch in the United States when I served in 1994, when Newt Gingrich and his group won the House and the Senate. And then the fever broke a little after the Oklahoma City bombing. And people realized all these people that got killed with his government protests, including their children in preschool in the building, were just like them. They had jobs to do and they were helping, and we needed their help. We needed them to do what they were doing. So I agree with that. I think that one of the things I'd like to see your generation do, we need to start asking people, well, what should the government do? If you want to have a great nation, if you want America to be great, and you want it to be a place of opportunity and growth, there are no examples of that anywhere on earth in countries that do not have strong, effective governments to do certain things. In other words, if you want a strong private sector, a precondition of it is having a strong and effective government. So how much do you think what you experienced at Boise State mirrored what you see going on in the real world today, and how much of it was different?
My experiences at Boise State were, I mean, very, very, very positive ones. I mean, I went into the program with a being in the racial and political minority, and knowing that this is a conservative white electorate that I have to speak to and to be elected from. And my strategy was to appeal to their sense of service and their sense of patriotism, that we didn't want to see this country go to the point that it inevitably ended up going to on January 6th. We didn't want a civil war. You know, when there was talks of secession of Boise State, as much of a joke as it could have been, to me, I found it very disrespectful of the Legionnaires.
The American Legion hosts Texas Boise State. The Legion is made up of veterans of armed services. To secede is to dishonor the memories and make their sacrifices in vain. We have the opportunity to do something great. Are we going to make headlines for the wrong reasons? Are we going to dishonor the Legionnaires who consider us to be the best that Texas has to offer? Or will we show the world what patriots are made of? That when things get tough, we pull ourselves by our bootstraps like true Texans and get after it. Leave Texas greater than it was when we found it.
That's right.
We aren't secessionists, damn it. We are nationalists, one nation under God, lovers of the Constitution of the United States of America. Let's do something great for Texas and amazing for the country. God bless every single one of you.
And I think that that speech that I gave catapulted me to my party's nomination for governor of Texas Boise State. And just seeing them united in the sense of this vision for the United States, for the vision of America, where we can have these disagreements, we can have differing opinions, and on some hills we'll die on defending some policy positions, whether it be, you know, immigration or abortion. But because we don't agree on all these issues, doesn't mean that we can't at least come to the table and have a discussion on maybe some areas within that issue that we do agree upon. Our job at Boise State was to show that those who are in government, that the younger generation could do it better than them, because we actually want to have these conversations with each other, and we want to have this debate and work together, not as Democrat, Republican, right, left, liberal, conservative, but as Americans who, at the end of the day, want what's best for their country. And I think all of us would have been very, very shocked if you told us in 2018 what would happen at the end of the Trump presidency. And I think that those kids that were there in my generation in general want to have a country when that they want to inherit a country, not on its last legs, but with a renewed spirit of reconciliation. It's just very disheartening to see, at the same time strengthening our resolve to make sure that, you know, our democracy got rocked on January 6th. It stumbled. It took a shot to the chin, but making sure that its resolve is stronger than anything that can be thrown at it, and making sure that we play a part in ensuring that this country that we've inherited is able to be inherited by those who come after us.
Well, obviously, I agree, and I think it's really important. The one thing that we have to remember that I learned there's a great difference between a poll of whether you support or oppose something and whether it's a voting issue for you. And what I think your generation can do is, on a lot of these critical issues, make it a voting issue. So that even if the culture seems to be tugging against you, you can prevail. When the school shooting occurred at Columbine, when I was president in Colorado, it was one of a whole series that occurred all the way from Oregon to my home state of Arkansas. Columbine seemed to galvanize the nation, and there was a lot of support for closing the gun show loophole because these guns had been bought at a gun sale. And keep in mind, at the time, the technology was not as advanced as it is now. It's laughable. It would be nothing to close the gun show loophole and nothing to have instant background checks for online sales. There were no online gun sales when I took office. So anyway, the Republican governor of Colorado, a conservative, supported a referendum to close the gun show loophole. The referendum passed 70-30. But Bush still defeated Gore 50-41. Now, nationally, if you look at what the Stoneman Douglas kids did, what they did was what happened at Columbine 20 years ago on steroids. They and their allies in Chicago and elsewhere made gun safety a voting issue in 2018. And that's what we have to do for all these issues. They have to be a voting issue. And one of the things I hope you've got out of your Boy State experience and all the stuff that's happened since then as a result of it, is it took me a long time to figure out how to make decisions with a strategy behind making an issue a voting issue. I would take a 50-49 issue if 100% of the people on my side were going to vote on the basis of it.
Right. It's walking a tightrope. I mean, I knew that, again, it's a very tribal setting that you're in. And a lot of the kids kind of, me being the dark horse in the race, all of the kids were taller than me, more handsome. They looked like the ideal politician, and I was not. And I decided to, knowing that as somebody who identifies as a Democrat, running in a sea of Republican was not advantageous to me. And I knew that I couldn't go on stage and list all these different policy positions that I held with and expect to get elected. I knew that what I had to do was appeal to their better senses of, you know, I get, you know, we're here to have fun, but let's do something. Let's do something that's never been done before. Let's all actually not treat each other like the enemy. Because I think the fault in the Boy State system is that when you get there, you're assigned a party, a color, blue, yellow, nationalist, federalist, and you're told that you hate this other party. You're told that they're the opposition and that you need to crush them and destroy them absolutely in these elections. And I think when you set that as what politics is, while it's not inaccurate to what politics is in the real world, It's definitely not the way we should be going about things. And so running on a message that appealed to conservative voters to vote for me, especially on the gun issue. I ran, you know, primarily as a pro-unity, pro-America candidate at Boise State, and I made it to the runoffs. In the 14-way primary, I got a third of the vote, and the second place person got 8% of the vote. And so we headed into a runoff. And a wrench was thrown into my strategy when people found pictures of me leading a March for Our Lives demonstration in Houston, which I was an executive organizer of. And so now I had to explain my position to a group of conservative people. And when I got up on the stage, man, they started booing me and jeering me and heckling me.
I am not anti-Second Amendment. I am pro-guns, but I'm also a common sense kind of person. For the collective security of the people, someone should not be able to own a rocket launcher. Exactly. And listen, I'm using it as a example.
You know, I had this prepared speech. I have to get rid of it. I can't use any of it now. I have to just address this.
But listen, not too long ago, Santa Fe High School was shot up not far from where I live. And that, it hurts, man. Those people, these kids who shouldn't go through these things, we can do something about it. We don't have to just, because we don't agree on everything, doesn't mean that we shouldn't come to the table and talk to each other. We should choose something, you know, we're going to protect our fellow teenagers and not just our teenagers, people going out to a nightclub, man, or a movie theater. We should have to worry about that.
But just talking to them about the fact that our generation, Columbine 1999, most of us were born in 2000, 2001. And all we ever known was school shooting drills, the siren. After Marjorie Stoneman Douglas happened, a few days later, in high school, we were all walking in the halls, and I was walking with a friend. And as we're all walking to our next class, the fire alarm goes off, which has never happened before. It's always predetermined. It's always scheduled. And we all know that one's going to happen. And so everybody just stopped. Hundreds of kids just stopped what they were doing and just kind of looked at each other, wondering what's going on. Or is something happening? And the teachers not also knowing what's going on, rushing us out of the building into the parking lot, telling us to get out of there, that this isn't planned. You know, your mind starts going to that dark place of what could be happening. And telling that to these conservative boys and saying that, no, you shouldn't be worried about going to school and getting shot, going to a movie theater and getting shot, going to a nightclub or a restaurant or a place of worship and fear these things. And some of these things we're not going to agree on, but there are so many things we can agree on that could prevent such things from happening. And we need to get that done. We need to show that the adults in the room that we can do it better than them, that we could actually tackle these crises together, because we've been through it and we've seen it. And we're tired of all this gridlock and partisanship of things never getting done. And by the end of that speech to them, they gave me a standing ovation. And in that runoff election, I won 70% of the vote in that room of white conservative boys against my candidate, who was unabashedly pro Second Amendment. Don't tread on me. Come and take it.
Well, I think that's the only strategy that works, what you said. You have to say, look, here's a problem. And your fellow Americans, in this case, or your fellow Texans, they got this problem. And we need your help. What I used to do in pushing all this gun stuff, I'd say, look, I'm not trying to interfere with your hunting, your sports shooting, even your right to protect your family and your home. But I do want you to help us keep guns out of the hands of people that even you think shouldn't have them. And we can't do that unless we can do comprehensive background checks of everybody. And I made a similar argument on the assault weapons ban. But I was always saying, instead of calling them names, I would say, we need your help. We need to call them out, give them a chance to be bigger. That's what you did when you one, I think.
And then there was a student too, and not many remember this, but a few weeks after Parkland, Santa Fe High School in the Houston area was shot up, and a number of students died. And I met with a student who was there when the shooting occurred at Boise State. His name was Riley. And we sat down after dinner. Riley was, like many people in the Santa Fe community, I think that the reason it didn't get as much attention is because that community was more conservative on guns and didn't place the fault of gun reform as the issue. They made it more mental health, the traditional way people, conservatives, talk about gun rights. And here I am, somebody who's never experienced being in a school shooting, and he has, and I, as somebody who has my views on it, I need to listen to him and hear what he has to say, because he's somebody who lived through it. And it was a very proactive conversation, and we disagreed on a few things, but you know, I explained the loopholes that universal background checks would close. And, you know, you wouldn't want somebody to have a gun who you can't trust, right? You wouldn't give just anybody a gun, would you? And he said no. And he's, you know, we walked away with a better understanding of each other and an agreement on an issue that he hadn't thought about before and agreed with. And we were on opposite sides of the political spectrum. And I think that's what's missing in today's politics, is that personal conversation, that personal connection with people, rather than, you know, calling each other out on social media, calling each other the enemy, trying to score political points, or, you know, favor with the media by starting something. I think that that's, you know, I think the film Boise State is about how can we bridge that divide in our country. Let's take a look at how some of America's youth is trying to tackle it. And it is very hard. I mean, ultimately, I don't win the governor's race. I do lose. But taking that loss as a point of pride, knowing that I was able to unite these people, was very, very, gave me hope for the future.
The thing I liked about you is, boy, you were hard over on what you believed, but you found a way to talk to people about it and to listen to them. Now things have gotten so polarized in America that you're suspect if you listen to somebody who disagrees with you, and you give them a forum and you give them a hearing and you look for a way where you might find common ground.
It's definitely not easy. And as much as I preach about the need to talk to one another, I've also fallen victim to that sense of tribalism and of you know, there are some things that I think about tweeting and I either don't tweet it out or I delete it as soon as I tweet it, just knowing that this isn't the right way to go on about doing the things that I want to help accomplish. That need for unity is so important that I think that this country will tear itself apart if we don't.
We'll be back with more of my conversation with Stephen Garza after this. I got a lot out of Boise State, including a lot of lifetime friends. But I think it's more important than ever that people like you, who believe in inclusive governance, inclusive societies, inclusive communities, do stuff that gives you the practical skills and the rhetorical insight to prevail. And like you proved in the election, you don't have to win everyone. Heck, I'd lost two elections before I ran for president. But I think this is important. We've got to get young people to get off the sidelines and into the arena.
And even myself had to cut, you know, when I first voted, I turned 18 the day before the midterm election in 2018. I was born November 5th, and the election was November 6th. And I registered to vote in September. You're able to register 17 years, 10 months. And the day of, I don't see my registration online. I keep checking every day, and I assume they'll put it in on my birthday because, you know, I'm not 18 yet. And the day of, I don't see it. So I call the elections office in Houston, and it's run by a Republican. And I asked them where my registration was. And they said, we don't have it. We don't have you in the system. And I said, but I have my registration stub right here. And they're like, okay, well, you need to come down to the election office before we close. Also, you know, it's like 30 minutes away and we close in like 45 minutes. So I, you know, wake up my mom who's taking a nap, and we rush over to the elections office, and I hand over my receipt that I registered to vote, and they sign me up to vote. And I go the next day after school, I go to vote at my precinct at a local fire station. And I give them all my information, and they say that I'm not in the system. And they're like, well, you're going to have to vote provisional. And so I'm annoyed, and I fill out my provisional ballot, and I, you know, vote, and I feel really happy about voting. And I go home, and 3 weeks later, I receive a letter in the mail stating that the provisional ballot board, who reviews all the provisional ballots, had denied my vote because I had voted in the wrong precinct. The thing was, is that I hadn't, and I knew that I hadn't, and I knew that I made sure everything was right, but they told me that I did. And so I had to contact the ACLU of Texas on my behalf to research and to reach out to the office. And their investigation concluded that, I had met obstacles every single way, from the loss of my registration to not being in the system on election day to having my right to vote, or being disenfranchised effectively by my vote not counting, because of an error made on their part every step of the way. Luckily, in that election, the Republican was ousted by a Democrat who assured me that they would make sure that this never happened again. And they kept their promise on that, because Houston and Harris County introduced countywide polling places that you'd be able to vote anywhere in the county.
Well, let's just follow up on that. The one thing that you don't learn at Boy State is that there's nobody there trying to stop you from voting. Everybody gets to vote, right?
Right.
So it is what it is. And demographically, it may not be like your community, and people may not be buying what you're selling, but at least if you can register, or you can be deemed as registering, and it's on the level. There's the apparatus in America, the amount of time and energy that is being spent by organized groups to keep people away from the polls is breathtaking. And as I said, there have been 100 bills introduced in state legislatures just since President Biden's victory to make it harder to vote. In Georgia, where the two Senate seats were won, there are bills now designed to eliminate vote by mail unless, one, you have an acceptable excuse, and two, you have a sworn affidavit stating that excuse that you signed. So I think that one of the things that, look, this is an old story. I can remember fighting with legislators in my native state who's actually believed it should be harder for people to vote, because you get a better class of people voting if it were harder to vote. And we all know what that's about. So, but that was 40 years ago, for goodness sakes. We don't need that. We need everybody to vote. We need people on deck here. And I think that whether this current trend continues, that is, depends first on the performance of the government in Washington, the administration. Secondly, on the willingness of some Republicans to work with the Democrats. And third, on whether we can protect the franchise. Because one of the things that we may have to start doing at Boy State is let people serve on the Supreme Court, too. Because these court decisions are unbelievable. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruled last year, while most of us, including me, were concerned with the presidential race, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that their the only constitutional right which could be violated with no consequence in the courts is the right to have your vote counted on a more or less equal basis. That is, they said gerrymandering absolutely can be unconstitutional, but the U.S. Supreme Court can't do a thing in the world about it because the Constitution lets state legislatures draw district lines. And that's just, first of all, it's an absurd decision because that's the 14th and 15th Amendment. Once slavery was ended, guaranteeing the right to vote and then equal protection of the laws meant that the federal government, the Supreme Court, could judge what states do. So it doesn't make a lick of sense, the decision, but the U.S. Supreme Court did decide it. So you're going to have to keep fighting for these things, and that's one that you could make your boy state speech on. Either y'all think everybody ought to be able to vote, or you don't. You think, you know, in America we're all equal, or we aren't. We'll be right back. Since you've been in college, you think that your generation, because of all the events of the last 5 to 6 years, is more willing to participate in politics and public service now or less?
I think they're definitely more willing because they realize that the stake that they have in this, that ultimately, again, we're going to inherit this country, and with that country comes all its problems. You know, as a young person, I guess I am still a young person. As a younger person, you know, being 14, 15, 16.
Trust me, you're so young.
Yeah. when I first got into politics and involved with the Democratic Party at 14, 15, people kind of were confused as to why I was doing it. And I said, well, I can't vote. So I don't have a say in what happens in Washington, D.C. I think I'm pretty well versed in what my beliefs are, and what I think is right and wrong. But I don't have a voice in Washington. I don't have a voice yet. The decisions that they're making while I'm 14, 15, 16, 17 years old are going to affect me when I'm 25, 35, 45, 50 years old. And so I thought it was very important for me to be involved. And I see that a lot of young people realize that the reason that college is so expensive, the reason that it's going to be hard for us to buy homes, the reason why wages are low, the reason why we're experiencing these climate events is because of government. And if we want us to be able to go to school at a reasonable level or at a reasonable price or own a home or, you know, make sure that we have a living wage and that we're not working paycheck to paycheck, just struggling to get by, and that, you know, going to see a doctor won't bankrupt us, that we need to be involved in politics. We need to be involved in government and be aware and, you know, just doing our civic duty to be aware of what's going on in our country and participating in it. And you don't have to become a political staffer or run for Congress to do so. It's just by voting and by taking your friends to vote, your family to vote, by, you know, reading the news, by staying engaged and up to date on what's going on, can sometimes be enough for somebody who doesn't want to pursue politics professionally. It's just making sure that they know what's going on and that they have an active participation, because, you know, every decision made is going to affect them and for a long time.
When I went to Washington to Boys Nation, President Kennedy met us in the Rose Garden. And he thanked us because we had just voted in our mock Senate session in Washington. We had just voted for the civil rights bill that he couldn't get through the Senate in the real life Senate because they had a filibuster rule. And I never will forget, he came down and it was a beautiful day in the Rose Garden in July of 1963. And he shook hands with us. All of us were in like the first two rows, he shook hands with us. And it made such a big impression on me that after I got elected president, I actually did a photo line so that every person there could get a picture, because It's like you, you know, you never dreamed 5 years ago that you'd be, everything would happen to you as a result of this movie, I don't think.
Right. Definitely not speaking to you today.
So I just decided I ought to do that. And I did it for 7 of the 8 years I was president. 1 year, my job required me to be out of town while Boys Nation, the week they were there, and I couldn't do a thing about it, but I otherwise always did it.
And it leaves an impression. I'm sure that left a huge impression on your life and kind of guided you to that sense of like, this is what you're destined to do. And so I feel the same feeling right now, getting the opportunity to speak with you right now. That sense of you know, I didn't expect to have, you know, 5 years ago, I didn't expect to be where I am today, but I think I'm doing something right. And so I plan on continuing the path that I'm on.
Well, I think you should. And I think you should encourage others. And I don't think you can get discouraged when things don't work out. I mean, it's amazing. You know, Hillary and I have been working on some of these things since the 1960s. And every time you think you got a battle won, something comes along and you fall back down the hill and you got to get up and dust yourself off and push the rock up the hill again. That's the work of democracy. You have to keep doing it.
Thank you. I will. And I want to say what a greatest honors of my life to be able to spend some time with you, Mr. President. And thank you for offering me the opportunity to learn from you and take your advice and your wisdom as I go on about this political life that I plan on pursuing.
I thought you were great in the movie. I thought it was a gutsy thing you did. I'm glad you stood your ground on the gun safety issue. And I'm glad to see the remarkable growth has continued in your life and your understanding since you made that film. And I wish you well. And just keep active.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Why Am I Telling You This is a production of iHeartRadio, the Clinton Foundation, and At Will Media. Our executive producers are Craig Manassian and Will Malnati. Our production team includes Mitch Bluestein, Jameson Katsoufis, Tom Galton, Sarah Horowitz, and Jake Young, with production support from Tyler Scott and Latavia Young. Original music by Watt White. Special thanks to John Sykes, Tina Flannoy, John Davidson, Angel Urena, Corey Gansley, Oscar Flores, Kevin Thurm, and all our dedicated staff and partners at the Clinton Foundation. If you have an idea or suggestion for the show, we'd love to hear from you. So please visit clintonfoundation.org/podcast to share your thoughts with us. If you like the show, tell someone else about it. You can subscribe to Why Am I Telling You This on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. By listening to this podcast, you're helping support the work of the Clinton Foundation. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Aisha Alexander. I'm Senior Impact and Design Manager and a proud alumni of the Clinton Global Initiative University, CGIU. President Clinton and Chelsea often say that you're never too young to make a difference. And at CGIU, we're working to engage the next generation of leaders on college campuses across the country and around the world to turn their big ideas for social change into meaningful action. Through our year-round program of mentorship, skills training, and partnership building, we're cultivating a community of more than 10,000 students and alumni who are committed to taking real concrete steps towards working together and solving the pressing global challenges that affect us all, from responding to COVID-19, to expanding access to clean water, to supporting refugees, and so much more. The students of CGIU demonstrate the future of impact. Learn more about this work and see how you can get involved. Visit www.clintonfoundation.org/podcast.